and this is Our American Stories. And we love to do, well, the news according to Jesse. And tonight, the running theme for Jesse's world is dumb criminals.
Police in Florida arrested 24-year-old Timothy Alejandro Ortiz after he set fire to his uniform after being fired from Burger King. He left the burning items on the ground and walked away before getting into several arguments with the managers and customers who saw what happened and called the cops. By the time deputies arrived at the Burger King, Ortiz had left the scene. He was later contacted outside of his home where he yelled and cursed at police. Ortiz was booked into the St. Johns County Jail on charges of damage to property, resisting an officer, and disorderly conduct. A New York man is accused of threatening to shoot employees and blow up the home goods store in Norwalk unless management fired his ex-girlfriend. 24-year-old Daryl Anderson of Bronx, New York, was arrested on charges of threatening, criminal trespass, stalking, and breach of peace when he was found hiding behind a tree at his ex-girlfriend's house. Canine bomb squad determined that the business was clear of any explosive devices. Anderson is being held on $75,000 bond. The old adage of don't get high on your own supply was not followed by two men who called police to turn themselves in after transporting marijuana through Madison County, Idaho.
Madison County 91.
Hi, we're the two dumbasses that got caught trying to bring some stuff through your border.
22-year-old Leland Doliente and 23-year-old Holland Sward were transporting roughly 20 pounds of pot from Las Vegas into Montana. When they entered Idaho, they believed they were being followed by undercover police. The men pulled over near U.S. Highway 20 and decided to call 911.
And where are you at right now?
University Boulevard, right next to the gas station in Applebee's. All your buddies are around us, so if you can help us out, it'd be great.
When officers arrived at their location, they found 20 pounds of weed inside of a dog kennel, both suspects waiting at the scene. Sward was put on probation for 5 years. Doliente faced a stiffer sentence of 1.5 to 8 years in prison after he tested positive for THC, cocaine, and oxycodone. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Great job, Jesse, and don't set your uniform on fire when you quit. Just walk. Just walk. And now it's time for something just a little bit more serious. We like to, from time to time, bring you a segment we call Final Thoughts. And that's where we learn from folks about death. Sometimes it's an obituary. Sometimes it's a lesson learned from somebody who's dying. And today, we have a really touching piece by Kristen Imbody. That's Kristen Imbody. And she's reporting from Great Falls and thus the Big Sky Country. And take it away, Kristen.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places. Got this heart of mine embraces all day through.
My nurse roommate came home in a state one night.
I have a story to tell you, she said. The story stayed with me, and when I think about what dying well means, that's what I think about. We say Montana is a small town with really long streets, and I ended up connecting with this couple's daughter. This is her version of what happened just before Christmas in 2012. Bob Otto, 73, and Emma Otto, 68, died as they lived, a testament to love. Bob was an outdoorsman who worked alongside his rancher son-in-law and took his grandkids fishing. Emma was a very kind-hearted woman who did everything she could for everyone and sent about 60 cards a month, recognizing birthdays and special occasions. For more than 2 months, the Ottos were in and out of the hospital with various ailments. They called each other from their hospital rooms in separate towers of the Benefice Health System and acted like teenagers in love whenever they got together.
My mom and dad were married 49 years, and I thought they were inseparable.
The Highwood couple's daughter, Monica Windler, said.
They didn't care about themselves. It was always each other.
Windler rushed to the hospital one day. Her dad was already in intensive care, and now the hospital was preparing to send her mom to Missoula after a heart attack.
You can't do that. You can't separate them,
she said. The options suddenly became fewer as Emma's condition worsened. Windler and her family gathered around her mom and prepared to take her off life support. When we got there, I said, Mom's going to go, and I'm going to lose both my parents in the same day, she said. I know my dad will die of a broken heart without my mom. Then a nurse stepped in to say, You'll never believe this, but your dad is crashing downstairs. The hospital staff was trying to revive him.
All right. I'm clear. You guys clear? Everyone's clear? Clear. Shot.
But Windler said to stop pounding on him. Instead, the staff brought Emma Otto to her husband's room and put their hands together. The minute they touched hands, they left. They died hand to hand, Windler said. They were Christian people, and what better way to go than with your soulmate?
I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
And that again was Kristen Imbody, and that was in the Great Falls Tribune. And here at Our American Stories, there isn't a story we won't cover, and we're not afraid to talk about things like these or stories like these because they're important and they're beautiful. Thanks for that, Kristen. And we'll be back with more after this. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we bring you every kind of story known to man. But in this segment we call The Letter, it's our favorite letters to the editor. And there was a tie with two that I ripped out of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to rip through them real fast, and then we'll be getting to the water cooler. Here's the first, by Alvin Thomas King of Fayetteville, Arkansas, responding to a minimum wage story that had been in the paper 2 days before. It's curious that in his piece by William Peace criticizing an economics professor for taking a narrow perspective in analyzing the effect of raising the minimum wage, he then does exactly the same thing. He concludes that raising the minimum wage would increase wages by 8% for a significant group and that those who lost jobs would receive unemployment compensation, resulting in a stimulus for the geographic area affected. This, of course, is a very incomplete and narrow picture. Where does this man suppose that the money for the 7.8% increase and additional unemployment compensation comes from? From others, obviously, whose incomes are now lower and who now have less to spend or to save. Perhaps he means that the economic effect would help some geographic areas while admitting that it hurts others. If this is what he means, he should say so. But that would interfere with his argument that free lunches are available. For some, maybe, but not for all, and not all of society as a whole. Please, he says, and this is the best part, if creating a significant economic stimulus were as easy as decreeing higher wage rates, why stop at the $15 minimum wage? Why not make it $20? Heck, make it $50. That way everybody has a lot more income. And sometimes there's just great wisdom. And the tie on the same page was about a regulatory story that was written by the Journal on Fishing. And here's Matt Wood from Bristol, Tennessee. I read with disgust Mr. Gathel's piece on the oppressive regulation of the New England fishing industry. It certainly has a familiar ring to it. Think of the dying coal industry in our area being slain not by market forces but by overregulation, empowered by an unbridled executive branch. Likewise, the medical profession, of which I am soon to be a non-participating member, is witnessing the demise of the private practitioner. We are being driven out of business by government regulations rather than by laws passed by the will of the people through their elected representatives. These trends bode ill for our country and our freedom. I hope the American people will soon rise up to the overregulation of their lives. Bureaucratic agencies that issue these edicts are not elected by the people, nor are they accountable to the people. All too often they are also anonymous. They hold far too much power, and that must change. And that's Matt Wood from Bristol, Tennessee. And the American people are smart. And we don't do left versus right on this show, but we do smart versus stupid and up versus down. And now it's time for our water cooler segment.
It's a horrible sound effect.
It is. It sounds like our toilet segment, but it's actually a water cooler. And it's time for Jesse and some of the stories that just might make some good water cooler chatter for you.
These are up at OurAmericanNetwork.com. I should get the name of the show right, or the website at least.
That's right.
.org.
It's .org.
.com? Man.
That's all right.
It's been a long water cooler day. Study claims that moderate drinkers are better off emotionally than those who don't drink at all.
I believe that. Oh, I totally believe that.
Overall, more than half of the U.S. adults, 54.9%, they have zero drinks per week. 41.4 say they do have up to 14 drinks per week. I can do that in probably one day, I think.
Oh, my goodness. So 14 drinks a week is just, you know, it's like my wife, a glass of wine a night or possibly two.
Yeah.
That's my New Year's resolution, by the way. Drink more.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very rare. But I don't drink at all, as you guys know. I mean, I just never drink. My wife says you should have a glass of wine now and then. So I'm trying.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I'm trying.
I've been cutting back myself, not because I have a problem with alcohol, but because I'm trying to lose some weight.
Oh, yeah. Beer is just not good for the gut.
It puts it on fast.
Oh, my goodness. It does.
These results were based on a telephone interview with random samples of 34,915 people.
That's a lot of calls.
I wonder why they stop at that number.
I know. That's true.
18 or older. So I guess they tested people.
And this is why I don't answer the phone anymore.
Aid to Palestine, that's a lighthearted...
Oh, yeah. Good segue.
I don't pick these topics. Aid to Palestine has been used to fund terror, according to this Wall Street Journal article. So the United States gives hundreds of millions to the Palestinians per year. In 2013, the Palestinians received $793 million in international aid, second only to Syria.
Wow.
It's quite a bit, a chunk of change.
Wow.
That amounts to $176 million $176 for every Palestinian. The highest per capita in the world.
People talk about that at their water cooler?
I guess. I don't know what water cooler this is.
I know.
Hey, guys.
Hey, you won't believe this. Do you know that the Palestinians are raking in $176 per from the aid of the world? All right, what do you got next?
Stress increases the risk of dementia. It also can cause depression, but you already knew that probably.
Yep.
It says a major review published research suggests. Well, I'm glad it's a major review, not a minor review.
Right, that helps.
Actually, it says chronic stress and anxiety can damage areas of the brain involved in emotional responses, thinking and memory, leading to depression and even Alzheimer's disease.
Why do these people do these studies? We know stress is bad.
Yeah,
what is the point?
It's pretty well established.
Yeah, next discovery. Work can lead to tiredness. On a positive note, doctors believe this type of stress-induced damage to the brain is not completely irreversible. Treatment with antidepressant drugs have been found to boost regeneration.
I do Luminosity, which I think has been really good for me. You ever do that with all the games that...
Yeah. You really do it?
Oh, I love it.
I didn't know antidepressants could physically repair your brain. Seems a bit slanted.
It does.
I think the author's a crackpot.
What else you got?
Let's see. Next water cooler topic. You know, we don't choose these. In the modern society, fathers are struggling to juggle career and home life. Millennial dads are more likely to feel burnt out than previous generations.
Oh, no kidding.
Poor babies. Fathers are now finding it as difficult as mothers to juggle work, family, and other stuff, I guess.
Even though they have less kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, less kids. By the way, my dad hears this stuff and he just starts laughing at me. Son, I had two jobs. I did the dishes. Look, you know, there were men who've been helping out around the house for a long time and taking their half.
Yeah.
But, oh, my goodness.
My wife just started going back to work just, you know, for fun of it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know.
What do you do around the house?
I cook the kids frozen burritos.
That's it?
No. It's really easy.
Oh, my goodness.
It takes like 2 minutes and, you know, they're fed. So modern parents are more likely to share child care, domestic chores, and work. But this has led to both being more prone to burn out. I don't think these are men. I think these are women. Okay, that's a joke. Why is there a little pocket inside your jeans pocket?
I want to know that.
It's a watch pocket. Back in the 1800s, cowboys used to wear their watches on chains and kept them in their waistcoats, keep them from getting broken. Levi's introduced this small pocket where they could keep their watch.
Okay. Is it still there? Do we still have it?
Yeah, it's still there. Yeah.
I keep guitar picks in mine.
Thanks for sharing.
They've listed some more fun facts about denim jeans. Boy, man.
Yeah, more.
Fun facts about pants. The word jeans comes from the cotton pants word by jeans. The term for Genoan sailors? Genoan sailors?
Genoan sailors, yes. Genoa.
Gotcha.
Yep.
The orange thread that Levi Strauss uses for stitching of their jeans is trademarked.
That's right.
It's used as a distinguishable feature.
I knew that.
To match the color of the copper rivets.
That's right. And the copper it is fascinating.
Lee's probably got a rant on this
one. I can tell you this because I just read Phil Lanchett's book, which is, I think, How the West Was Won or something like that. Levi Strauss was like, he was like the first major brander. And so doing stuff like that to distinguish one from another, patenting it on design, nobody'd ever done stuff like that before. So, you know, hats off or jeans off to,
pants off
to Levi. Pants off to
the
Levi.
The last fun fact about jeans, they were originally called waist overalls.
Waist overalls.
And that's all we got.
Yeah, well, that's great. And that's Charlie Richards' work. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. And there's always something there you can use. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Early this morning, knocked upon my door. Early this morning, knocked upon my door. And I said, hello, Satan, I believe it's time to go. Me and the devil were walking side by side. Me and the devil were walking side by side.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to a great old classic, and there's a reason you're listening to it, because we're going to be digging into the life of Lisa Ling and what she's up to with her one-hour shows on CNN. I don't know if you've caught some of them, but we just think they're a little, well, they're just a little strange, and the subject matter is just a little odd, and so we're going to follow this show along, and you know, we love all aspects of the culture. We love telling you about music. We love telling you stories about, well, almost everything that has to do with the arts. We did a great hour on Pacino, on Scorsese, and we just celebrate it. But every once in a while, we want to put on the cultural critic hat and say, what the heck's going on? And I don't know, and none of us know. I had Hengler on this beat, and he said, Lee, this is a little strange. Let's take a listen. And so that's what we're doing. And the show, by the way, is called This Is Life with Lisa Ling. And I always get a little scary when I hear something like that, because it's purporting to say that it's one thing, but maybe it's another. And maybe it should say this is Lisa Ling's view of life, and then go from there. And it's preparing for its third season of programming, where the award-winning journalist goes on what CNN calls a, quote, gritty, breathtaking journey to the far corners of America. And let me tell you, you're going to hear about some far corners today, and we'll do a follow-up. We have another one in the can ready to go next week, and it gets even a little stranger. In many of these so-called far corners of America, Ling explores the darkest parts of humanity. And like most of Lisa Ling's reporting, and we're putting sort of quotes around this kind of reporting because it's sort of like, well, experiential reporting, she manages to sympathize with, as you'll hear in this episode, literally, the devil.
What?
He had a good side. You see, we've been following this broadcast so you don't have to. Or if you stumble upon it, you don't feel alone. And we'll bring you the jaw-dropping highlights from many of their most, well, let us just say, shameless episodes. Because I don't know who's editing this thing. I mean, is there anyone in the editing booth who's going, what the heck?
When I'm going through it, in my mind, I have her over the head of the editor telling him what to cut. That's,
really?
That's what's in my head.
Yeah, so that's what's in your head?
Yes.
But I mean, at some point in time, it's got to go to like somebody at CNN who has nothing to do with the project,
right,
and they watch it, and they're either going thumbs up or they're calling their boss and going, hey, boss, we got a really strange segment here. So today we're going to feature the episode, The Satanist Next Door. The Satanist Next Door. It already sounds warm and inviting, doesn't it? They're just our friendly neighbors, that's all, Satanists. The Satanist Next Door. All righty then. But like all things CNN and Lisa Ling, there's an agenda. And this episode pits Satanists against, what do you know, Christians. And guess what side Lisa Ling and CNN champion? Well, you'll have to hear this one to believe it. The show highlights the Satanic Temple's yearly national get-together in Detroit. Why did Detroit get the nod? I mean, this is not something you want to put down as some of the great conventions that come into your town. But this is only a tiny sliver of the story that is shown at the end of the episode. Ling begins the program by setting the stage, just like a good shoot 'em up Western movie. Who are the good guys? Who are the bad? And we're introduced to our first Satanist, a single mom who is driven to the Church of Satan because, as she tries to contend, one try to follow the logic here, her gay son, and this is a terrible tragedy, committed suicide. By the way, my family experienced a tragic suicide almost a year ago. So no joking matter that. But why is the question. And she says that it's the church's fault because the church didn't agree with homosexuality. That's why the kid killed himself. Yes, her answer is abstract, but she has an even more specific answer as to why she now follows Satan.
Your son is one of so many gay kids who have either committed suicide or died as a result of pressure from communities for being gay. Do you blame the church?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I blame any religion that thinks they can dictate not only our marital laws, but who you love. There's a lot of people that are hurting because of these Christian precepts, and I don't want any more kids to have to go through what he went through. Satanists, they understand my pain and my anger. When I read the tenets for the Satanic Temple, it all worked for me. I'm passionately religious about civil rights and humanity. And, you know, I don't know why that can't be a religion. I don't know why people have a problem with that. So I just want to protect the rights of future generations so that they will have a brighter future without this type of ridiculous discrimination that should not even exist. There's a lot of work to be done yet.
The Satanists have a lot of work to get done. And I'm listening to this first clip. Greg, I guess I shouldn't be shocked, but, well, Again, how does this get through the meter? Again, it's CNN. How are we getting this through the media? I mean, again, we don't want to be laughing about the tragic occurrences. This is not about this woman. This is really about Lisa Ling. So know that. We're not going at folks who are Satanists. The question is, why is CNN covering this? What's Lisa Ling up to? So remember the real focus of this segment. And again, this woman's tragedy, you're reaching at this point. You're trying to find some things. But why is Lisa Ling thinking this is really great programming?
Yeah, and after the first clip, the first thing to ask yourself is, she's blaming the church for having these beliefs, but in what way did they coerce her son or move her son to the direction of suicide?
Right.
She doesn't make any connection. She just blames them because they believe something that against the lifestyle he was leading. So why would they even air that clip? In what way? So every homosexual can blame the church because they don't believe what they believe? Like, I don't understand. They didn't make that connection.
No, they didn't make the connection because there probably isn't one.
Right.
And shame on the reporter, Lisa Ling, for not trying to dig into that and figure out what was really going on. And how did Lisa Ling get this story? Like, I always wonder about these things. How did they even find this person?
It sounds completely made up almost, just on the spot. This woman just comes out of the blue and says, oh, I worship Satan now. Like, she's a soccer mom and she has pentagrams on the back of her minivan going to...
It makes no sense.
It's ridiculous.
It makes no sense. And to have seen, because, you know, Greg sent me the link and I watched this and it was all put together like it was real.
Yeah.
And like this had been thoroughly researched and vetted. And so that's, again, what is Lisa Ling up to, but with programming like this, what is CNN up to?
Bizarre.
And they're a news organization. And this is certainly not news. And it's not really, well, as you're going to learn, it's you can't even wonder whether it's in any way legitimate. So let's keep going. Right now we know that it's the evil church that drives people to commit suicide, and Satan drives people to good works and activism for civil rights. Because that was the Martin Luther King story, right? I mean, that's what we learned when we celebrated Martin Luther King for 2 hours. Satan guided him. I mean, what rubbish. What rubbish. The greatest civil rights accomplishments this world has ever known, from Wilberforce in England to the suffragette movement here, and, of course, the civil rights movement in this country, and, for that matter, the Underground Railroad, was all people of faith doing these things and risking their lives. So Ling isn't finished putting the black hat on the bad guys. Next, she's going to move on to the next Christian moral position she can't stand, and that's on the subject of life. And again, we don't, you know, here on Our American Stories, we don't really take positions on these matters. But let me tell you, when we bump across stuff like this, we want to bring it to your attention. And, well, it's really, really strange. And when we come back, you're going to hear more from Lisa, from CNN, from the Satanists, and more from us. And again, we're going to be trying to figure out and get inside the mind of Lisa Ling. What is she up to? And again, what is CNN up to with this
ridiculous
is life with Lisa Ling? More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this half hour, we're looking into the CNN show, This Is Life, with Lisa Ling. And the particular episode we're looking into right now is The Satanists Next Door, and thus the music from Mick Jagger, Sympathy for the Devil. And we had learned before that this woman they're highlighting in this story, son had committed suicide. And he was gay, so of course the mom instantly thought it's the church's fault. And Lisa Ling just takes that hook, line, and sinker and keeps going. And we had left off with Lisa Ling putting the finishing touches on the bad guys, sticking that black hat on the bad guys. Had to be the church that did this. And she moves on to the next moral position because she can't stand their position on something else besides homosexuality. They're going to attack the church for another position.
There's a war raging in America over abortion. In Michigan, nonprofit clinics called crisis pregnancy centers are being funded by conservative politicians with pro-life agendas. These centers claim to provide medically sound advice, but the Satanic Temple suspects false advertising and another instance where the line between church and state is being crossed.
These laws are religiously motivated and very harmful to women.
29-year-old Shiva Honey has always been passionate about women's rights, but struggled to put her ideas into action. That is, until she became a Satanist.
Then everything made sense.
Then everything.
Get those dastardly Christians.
Yeah, because they're setting up pregnancy centers, and what could they be up to? Like maybe trying to get another opinion for a woman, so she goes to Planned Parenthood and she gets one opinion. She goes to the pregnancy center and she gets another. And again, what's Ling up to here? Why is she doing this? And what separation of church and state divide does she have in her mind that Christians can't do what they do and secularists can't do what they do?
And how much fun must she be at a cocktail party?
Oh, my goodness. This is a downer programming. And again, it's what is Lisa Ling up to? And by the way, when you see next week, she travels with a biker gang that's one of the most dangerous in America, and she makes it look like they're just a nice little fraternal organization. This is life with Lisa Ling. I'm glad I'm not along for the ride. Oof. So again, what's she up to? And we're going to follow these. And again, we love the culture. So we're not, you know, if you're thinking you're tuning into one of those shows that hates Hollywood or ever says the word Hollyweird, not us. We love what comes from so much of our media. So much of it is good. So much of the content's good, and we celebrate all the stuff that's good. But this is downright, well, strange is being giving it the benefit of the doubt. So they're not done. Ling, as you will hear, is using Satanists, using Satanists for some other animosity that I think she and they bear towards Christian causes. Listen to her pitch this lobbing softball question as her Satanist friend quickly knocks it straight out of the ballpark.
So you believe that these conservative Christian values are interfering with women's rights and women's reproductive rights?
I absolutely think so.
I absolutely think so. That's a tough question, Lisa. Move over Mike Wallace. Rest in peace. So Ling continues her Christian witch hunt as she follows two Satanists who were going undercover into Christian crisis pregnancy centers in an attempt to expose them for being, wait a second, hold your breath, pro-life.
In a suburb of Detroit, Jex and Shiva are getting ready to take the Satanic Temple's investigation one step further. And it requires urine from a pregnant woman.
Oh, boy. Very dramatic. Here's what their investigation uncovered.
So what happened when you got inside?
They wanted to know if I was leaning towards abortion so that they could go through dangers and risks involved with that.
How evident was it to you in person that they were trying to strongly dissuade you from terminating a pregnancy?
It was incredibly obvious. It really was, you do not want to get an abortion.
Did you notice any like religious publications or anything like that?
Yeah, immediately there was a question about God. They said one of the risks of abortion is damaging my relationship with God. And then there was other types of religious propaganda in the room itself.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh my goodness.
Religious propaganda.
There might have even been a Bible. Shocking. So that's it, folks. After all this deep and heavy investigative reporting, it turns out that the folks in this place were trying to encourage this woman to save her baby. This has to be heartbreaking, by the way, for Lisa Ling and her new Satanist co-conspirators. That said, the show moves to the Satanic Temple's national gathering in Detroit. My goodness. Jesse, you want to cover that this year?
That's going to smell horrible.
That has got to be awful. But, you know, just wear black. You'll fit in. And that's where they're going to be revealing their brand new giant satanic statue. So it's getting really exciting. We can't wait. I don't know if you remember Spinal Tap, but it reminds me of the, you know, remember when they had to have the Stonehenge and that was there? Well, I'm thinking the same thing about this temple.
I'm willing to bet a lot of these so-called Satanists still live with their mommies at home.
I think
they have their little Satan pajamas.
I think they're in the basement. The problem is here, according to CNN and Ling, anti-Satanist Christian protesters are present at the event. This lends itself to another opportunity for Ling to knock the Christian church while promoting the satanic church.
Before getting full access, attendees are required to sign their souls away to the devil. Another move the temple hopes will dissuade protesters from infiltrating the event.
They're trying to remain calm, not antagonize anyone, and try to make things go as smoothly as possible.
Studies show that increasingly young people are turning their backs on the church. They're rejecting traditionally held values and creating their own rules. But passing on a Judeo-Christian faith doesn't mean that young people don't long to believe in something. And that's why this group is here.
Yeah, move over, Mother Teresa.
I think she's trying to recruit people.
I think she is. I mean, she's making the Satanists look good. She's making the church look terrible. And I just have to ask myself, and I know we are at this crew, what is Lisa Ling up to? Let's go. We're not finished. There's more, folks. Now it's time for the satanic statue unveiling. I'm dying. I can't wait. And I'm going to describe it because you can't see it. And what could easily be labeled CNN's free advertising for the Satanic Church.
Nearly 700 people have turned out tonight for Satan. And some are even embracing Lucifer's look. But mostly, this crowd is here to witness the symbol of their faith live and in person for the very first time.
This stuff has been pent up inside of us for a long time. But this is a moment to rip that veil open and say, we're here.
We claim our satanic status with pride and demand that our rights are respected, just as anybody else's.
It is done. Hail Satan.
Oh, hail Satan!
This is Baphomet. Whatever you make of it, this statue means something to these people.
I feel like I found my tribe, a group of people who I really can identify with intellectually, creatively, philosophically. It all goes back to the things that we fight for.
In the fight for religious freedom, Baphomet is both a symbol and a tool, and it could show up in a town near you.
I would have never considered myself ever belonging to any religious group or organization, but I'm now a part of that conversation. We're doing very good work that one day will set the seeds for something better than ourselves.
Hey everybody, let's get around and worship a goat statue.
Yeah, sounds great.
That's my Lord and Savior.
Yep. And it's coming to, by the way, notice that Lisa Ling said it's coming to a town near you. Yeah. Like, she's excited about this. This could be a send-up on Saturday Night Live, except it's not. It's CNN devoting an hour. And by the way, this is in reruns. You can see it about a dozen times through the year, right next to Anthony Bourdain's travels around the country. But good works from the followers of Satan, says Ling, and CNN. Well, here's the final clip from the episode that always ends up with a Jerry Springer-like conclusion from Lisa Ling so that viewers don't miss the point of her show, because we couldn't follow it, Lisa. We weren't getting it. Good. We know who the good guys and bad guys are in your mind. Here's Lisa Ling with her epilogue.
No matter what this group says their objectives are, no matter how hard they fight for people, because they've chosen Satan as their representative, they will continue to provoke people. They'll continue to anger people. But that's the point.
That is the point, Lisa. And then the other point is that folks like you would actually give them an hour airtime and treat them seriously. And, of course, at the same time, hammer people of faith who really do care about it. And does it mean Christians are perfect? Of course not. And are there bad Christians? You bet. Are there good Christians? Yes. Are there good atheists? Of course there are. This isn't the conversation. What is Lisa Ling up to? Well, don't let Satanist belief in Satan upset you. I think that's the moral of the story. I don't know. I doubt it, Lisa. And we're gonna start to try and get in touch with Lisa after we do a couple of more of these. Because we'd like to ask her ourselves, Lisa, what are you up to? And Great work on this, Greg, and I'm sorry I had to sit through it. But what's up next for Lisa? What's she doing? Is it that biker gang?
Yeah, the Mongols.
Oh, the Mongols.
Yeah.
Oh, great. They're worse than Hell's Angels.
Yeah, it's portrayed as a step below maybe a gang in a James Dean movie or something. Just a bunch of nice guys sipping Diet Cokes in the local restaurant.
Yeah, like a poker club or the Rotary Club.
Yep.
Except with leather jackets and a Harley. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Great job on this, Hengler. More after this. Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our Wall Street Journal story of the day. And the Wall Street Journal isn't just for business readers, folks. It's America's journal. Pick it up. And once again, we're going to hear from their regular contributor and our resident doctor on the show, Dr. E. Wesley Ely, a professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University. And here's Dr. Ely sharing his moving story, What I Learned from a Dying Patient. I'm learning to live without you now, but I miss you, baby. The more I know, the less I understand. All the things I thought I'd figured out, I have to learn again. I had a patient recently whose death was particularly harrowing. 39 years old, PhD, scientist, brilliant. She was sent to the ICU team as a fascinoma, meaning a person with a constellation of problems the doctors couldn't figure out. This woman had been physically fine until 2 months earlier, and now she was growing progressively short of breath, had a little blood in her urine, and had pain in her toes, which were turning blue and red in the cold. Imaging showed that she had a growth on her aortic valve and that sections of her kidneys were dying. The doctors at the outside hospital had diagnosed her with blood clots in her lungs and started her on a blood thinner, but her condition kept worsening. As the day progressed, we started all the needed tests and interventions to help sleuth out the problems and fix them. Hours into my periodic conversations with her and her mother and sister, her mother mentioned that my patient was agnostic. I realized that up to that point, perhaps because of the sheer rapidity of the way things were unfolding, I had neglected to take a spiritual history. Since I teach medical students and residents in physical diagnosis class about the importance of taking a spiritual history, you'd think that I wouldn't fall prey to this oversight, but I had. The literature shows that most patients want to be asked about their spiritual beliefs or non-beliefs, and that many think it rude if healthcare professionals don't consider this important aspect of their well-being. The question should be asked out of respect and in a non-judgmental manner. Thus I said to her, "Do you have any spiritual values that you want me to know about that might influence your medical decisions?" We'll get to her answer in a minute. Within 24 hours of our meeting, the patient had been checked with an array of blood tests and imaging studies, and there it was. The biopsy showed angry cells with too much nuclear size for healthy cytoplasm and prominent nucleoli. Cancer. It was everywhere then. It became a whirlwind because she got shorter of breath by the hour as the cancer and fluid literally filled up her lungs. We went from her arrival in the hope of figuring out what was wrong and seeking a cure, talking about how when she got back to her lab and students, she'd resume where she'd left off, to the depths of despair. The patient's conversations with her sister were difficult, to say the least, and at times they both got weak. Eventually, they affirmed that they had to pave a way
to prevent my patient's further suffering. With her mother, however, it was much worse. She looked at me through tears and fear and screamed, "This is not fair!" over and over. Her sister began printing off her will from an iPad and having things notarized. It was surreal. I won't forget my patient's look of shock and surprise, as if she'd heard me wrong. When I told her that the cells we'd seen under the microscope were cancerous and that the cancer had already spread throughout her body. Only 8 hours after we'd told her that she had this incurable illness and that our hope, which at the time seemed plausible, was to get her off the ventilator so she could talk to her family, she stopped breathing and died quietly without any apparent awareness of suffering. Throughout the day, I had tried to be diligent about ensuring that she was able to spend time with her mother and sister. The initial challenge was to use a specific approach towards sedation that balanced her comfort and her clarity of mind so that she could really engage with the family. My last memory of this young scientist is that of her breathing, unconscious and unaware of her surroundings. At this point, she was newly comatose on the sedation and painkillers as we removed the breathing tube and ventilator. I urged her family, nevertheless, tell her what you want her to know. It helps families to have no regrets in the days that follow. The story is many things, and to you it no doubt means something different than it does to me. As this woman's physician, I find that one of the most enduring aspects of the story was the palpable oneness I felt with her, and in knowing how in sync we were with everything, body and mind. There was an unusually tight connection, and I sensed that we both knew it. Since antiquity, the greats such as Plato and Aristotle have taught us the concept of body, mind, and spirit as the fullness of existence, a triad still embraced by many today. My patient and I were in tune after talking about those first two, and then, when I took her spiritual history, she perceived that our beliefs diverged. She affirmed what her mother had told me, "Yes, I'm agnostic, and it's okay that we differ on that." I nodded and was left to wonder how and why, without having talked about this earlier, she had both understood that we differed in this third piece of the triad and thought it important to offer me reassurance. An autopsy will answer many things, like what was growing on her heart valve and the source of her cancer, which we think was bowel, pancreatic, or ovarian. But no physical finding, microscopic sighting, or laboratory test is going to help me learn any more about her spiritual side. I remember her loving manner and her inquisitiveness about life. I know that she was thinking of her estranged father, her students, and her nieces, whom she'd never see again. She wasn't sure about the existence of the divine, but her courage, daring to face what was happening despite not wanting to hear the worst possible news, utterly confirmed the human spirit. She revealed the connectedness we have in all of our imperfect, vulnerable lives, and I can still feel it now.
And again, that's Dr. E. Wesley Ely, a professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University. He writes often for the Wall Street Journal and contributes here at Our American Stories, beautiful stories like that. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, as often as we can, we like to review the latest Shark Tank episode, because it's one of our favorite shows on television. And by the way, on Our American Stories, we just love the entertainment world. We love music. Go on to our website, ouramericannetwork.org, and listen to our tribute to Glenn Frey. And his life's work. Also, Carole King and Aretha Franklin, Robert Plant, Irving Berlin. And we've got so much more to do on the music space. I think Jesse's favorite was Greg Allman, because Jesse loves guitars. And also check out Jesse's Searching for the Crossroads, because we sent him off. We live here in Oxford, Mississippi. Jesse's from Oregon and loves the blues. And so he wanted to do a piece, and we were troubleshooting what to do. And he had this idea of going out to the place where Robert Johnson supposedly sold his soul to the devil. And he wanted to go out and find that actual location. And what a piece of reporting it is, and it's just good fun. And, well, I'm not going to tell you how it ends, because why would I do that? But again, ouramericannetwork.org.
It ends, he dies.
Oh, that's right. Robert Johnson
does die.
He might
get physical success. What, was it 29 he died?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so he is dead. Robert Johnson is still dead. That just reminds me of Chevy Chase when he came out every week and he said, Generalissimo Franco is still dead. And every week he would come out and report that the dictator was still dead. But again, it's Shark Tank time. And, well, we start off with David Hegarty. And he's the man who's up next in the tank. And we love the Shark Tank because it's a bunch of people with a whole lot of money who only 20 years ago didn't have any. And now they have money. And there's a bunch of people pitching the guys who have money so that they can get their businesses, well, propped up, moving along, getting to the next level. And they don't just want the money, these contestants. More often than not, they want a commodity that's just as important, maybe more important than the money. And that's the knowledge that goes along with capital. And this is what's great about free enterprise in the end. It's not just how we move around capital and create wealth, but it's how we move around human talent and knowledge. And so that is so often what the folks want. And it's pairing up the right partners. Mr. Wonderful always likes, for the most part, intellectual property moves. The FUBU guy, well, he just loves mostly retail and things that, well, fall in line with his expertise. Mark Cuban's all over the place. He's in so many businesses, has a broad array of talents and a wide plate. And I think that's true of Robert. And then periodically there are some guests that come on and help out too. This week it's Chris Sacca. But now David Hegarty, he's up in front of the tanks and his company's name is Fixed.
My name is David Hegarty, and I'm from San Francisco, California. My company is Fixed, and we are seeking a $700,000 investment for a 5% equity stake.
Wow. So at a 5% equity stake, and the business is worth $700,000, or for $700,000, what are they pegging the valuation of their business?
Is it $14
million? $14 million. Very
ding,
good.
Ding, 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 I was sweating over here.
$14 million. By the way, I do this with my little girl, and I think people are doing this all over the country. My little girl can peg valuations of business. Now, the question becomes, is that the proper valuation? And very often, there's a good business. There's a good idea. The sharks like it, but they're really mad at the people for coming in with a ridiculous valuation. And rarely do people undervalue their company. Just like when they go to sell their houses or anything else, the seller always thinks something is worth more than often what the buyer wants to pay. So what is Fixed, David, and what does it do?
Fixed is the app that fights back. So how does it work? Step one, take a photograph of your parking ticket. Step two, that's it. There is no step two. It's that simple. We take that parking ticket, we run it through our proprietary algorithm to look for issues and errors that make that ticket invalid. When we find an issue, we assemble a contest letter on your behalf and send it to the city. 4 weeks later, you find out that your ticket has been dealt with.
Wow, where were you when I was living in New York and piling up $1,000 a year worth of parking tickets? Thanks a lot. So what's the business model? And what's the success rate?
So tell us the business model. Certainly. It's a free app download. You submit your ticket. If we beat your ticket, we charge a 35% success fee.
What's the success rate?
We win about 20 to 30% of our contests.
So how many people just do it themselves?
So in San Francisco, only 5% of parking tickets are contested. And those that are contested, I think the win rate is about 20%.
Well, that's not bad. I mean, I guess you could just use these guys to save you the time and the hassle. I mean, that's an expensive day. Just the parking parking to go to fight the parking ticket is probably as much as the parking ticket in San Francisco. So what's a typical reason a ticket would be dismissed?
There's lots of different reasons. So initially, we look for errors. So the statutory information that the officer has to write down. Frequently, they're in a rush. They don't write that information. They made a typo on the license plate. They wrote Acura when it's an Audi. We look for all these issues that make the ticket invalid.
Wow, that's good. That is good. How many tickets are issued a year? And what are the sales?
But how many tickets are issued per year in America?
We estimate 100 million tickets written a year.
So this is a major source of income for the police.
Oh, huge source.
What's the average penalty or ticket?
In San Francisco, the average ticket is about $70.
Are you operating anywhere else right now?
Yeah, we are in San Francisco, Oakland, Los Angeles, and New York.
All right, tell us about the business. You have a $14 million value on the business. It must be huge. What are your sales?
This year alone, I think we've done $80,000 in net revenue.
There's about to be some trouble on this set. So he has $80,000 a year in net revenue, and they're asking for $14 million basically as a business valuation. Again, they want $700,000 for 5% of the business. So how much do they make on an average contested ticket? And what does it cost to acquire an actual paying customer?
From an average ticket, we make about $5 to $6 in revenue.
So you only make $5 or $6 per success?
That's a combination of our 35% win rate when we beat the ticket. And if we have to pay the ticket for you, we charge you a $195 convenience fee.
What's it costing you to acquire the incremental customer?
We acquire users for a blended average of about $4 to $5.
That's not exciting.
Is that paid marketing? I mean, is that Facebook and Twitter ads?
No. We have a team of people that follow the street cleaning vehicles in the city.
Come on.
And put a flyer on the cars that have a parking ticket.
Ooh. It's actually smart. It's just expensive.
It's really expensive. Well, Robert, Mr. Wonderful, Lori, and Chris Sacca, in or out?
I'm out.
I don't think I want to invest in a business that goes to war with government revenue. I just think it's bad karma for me. I'm out.
I can't wrap my hands around if it's going to really work or not. And for that reason, I'm out.
Placing a bet on this business is placing a bet against Uber. So for that reason, I'm out. Okay.
I get that logic because Uber, well, people won't drive and park anymore because they'll just take taxis around. I mean, that's his logic. Mm-hmm. I don't quite get that. I think people always drive their own cars, at least for a long time, and park. I think sometimes these techies get a little ahead of themselves with how the human beings
I just wanted to do an lives. Uber plug there on national
yeah,
TV.
I think that was just an Uber plug. So everyone is out, everyone except Mark Cuban. What does he have to say?
Look, I love the idea of kicking the government up the ass.
Oh, that's such a bad idea.
I like it more.
We're in the same boat.
Nothing I like.
So wait, this is the money that actually builds the roads, funds the libraries, builds the homeless shelters.
Oh, wait,
you
so
want to be on that
the,
side
this
of the
is
equation?
From the person that says, you know what? No more cars, which means no more tax money from that, no more sales
tax.
If
you're considering this a tax, this is the most regressive tax that is out there.
I completely agree.
The people who are getting parking tickets are not the people with Ferraris you can put in a garage. They're people who don't have a garage, who need their car for their job. It is the most regressive tax.
What are you doing, Mark? Yes or no? On or off? Up or down?
Well, Cuban's interested, but will he bite?
What I'll offer you is your $700,000 for 7%, right? And we can structure that extra 2% as advisory fees, whatever you want.
I want to make sure that I have your word, that we have, you know, full commitment from you and you're available when we need you to help us out.
Sure.
We have a deal.
Done.
Whoa, I would have said no chance. No chance. But I'm telling you, Mark Cuban sees an opportunity and he probably has a different way to get the customers. And he's thinking 100 million tickets. Plus, he hates the government because they falsely prosecuted him. And he went after him and took him all the way to court and all the way to trial and vindicated his name. So it's personal for Mark Cuban. Great segment. Great job on that, Jesse. And that's why we love Shark Tank, folks. It's a human drama. It's a great story. It's great storytelling. And we'll bring you Shark Tank every time there's a new one. And sometimes we'll bring you one of the great old ones, too. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And if you've ever had a chance to see the musical about Carole King on Broadway, you must. It's terrific. What a life she lived. And she was very young, very precocious, and had a real writing talent. And she wrote this song, and that's her singing this song. And she was honored recently at the Kennedy Center, in the Kennedy Center Honors, which is, I think, perhaps the greatest honor any artist, scientist, public servant can have. I'm speaking for them, but I've heard many of them say it. And it was quite a night. We're going to get to that night, but just a little backstory, because that song that Carole King wrote, along with Jerry Wexler and her partner for so many years, Jerry Goffin, was a huge hit for her on the album Tapestry, but it was the record that it was a hit, not the single. And there was this remarkable singer in Detroit, an African-American singer. And she had been signed by CBS Records to a pop career that fizzled and was dropped. And the folks at A&R, Atlantic Records, well, they had other ideas and other intentions. And the young woman's name is Aretha Franklin, African-American girl from Detroit, born in Memphis, collides with a song written by this Jewish girl from Manhattan. And, well, let's take a listen to what happens. Here's Aretha Franklin's version of Carole King's version that you just heard.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. Another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, and you're the key to my peace of mind. 'Cause you make me feel, you make me feel, you make me feel like a natural woman.
And that's what happens, folks, when a great songwriter meets a great singer. And what a story of race in America. This wasn't planned by any chance and by any choice. But the soulfulness of Carole King's songwriting and the soulfulness of Aretha Franklin's singing merged. And where did they merge? In the oddest of places, not in some fancy recording studio in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, but a little tiny place in Alabama. A little tiny recording studio called Muscle Shoals, in the town of Muscle Shoals, and a band of young white kids called the Swampers. And in the great movie Muscle Shoals, which you all must see, there's a great moment where Aretha Franklin, this urban girl, walks into this farm town studio with a bunch of hick musicians, and no one knows what to think or say. And so she does what any good musician would do. She sits down at the piano and she just starts to sing and play the universal language of music.
She walks in right over there. And she's got this aura around her, pretty thick. I mean, the girl was special. I remember watching the guys, being good Southern boys, they'd carry on with anything except looking or dealing with her. So she walked right over to the piano. She sat there a moment, and then she just hit this unknown chord, I would say. Didn't anybody have to say we're about to cut?
We did what we called head sessions at that time, and there was no real music written for it. The musicians would just listen to what it was I was doing, and then they would decide what they were going to do around that.
I think we heard a little demo of this song, Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You.
To me, it sounded pretty much like junk. I'm thinking, that's a song they're going to cut?
And they went on to cut that song first, and then just a couple of other good ones, like the one you heard Carole King sing and Aretha, and also a little tiny one called Respect. And then many more. And the Swampers ultimately left the studio of Rick Hall, started their own deal. Watch the documentary. It's amazing. It's about race in America. It's about music. It's about so much. Now let's take it back to what we were talking about. And it's that Kennedy Center honors. And there's Carole King up in the booth sitting next to the President of the United States. And all these different performers come out to sing their versions of their favorite Carole King song. And the last woman who shows up comes in, sits down at that piano, just like she did all those years back in the late 1960s at Muscle Shoals. And let's take you there to the Kennedy Center.
Aretha Franklin.
Now, while Aretha is sitting at the keyboard singing, I mean, the audience is mesmerized. And I got to tell you, there's barely a dry eye in the house because everybody's looking up at Carole King. And Carole King is just crying like a, well, like a baby, because she was witnessing something so beautiful. Again, these two people from such different walks of life centered around a beautiful, beautiful love story. Because that's what this song is in the end, about a man who makes a woman feel like a natural woman. And boy, don't we all as men want to do that? Be the guy in that song. And so then Aretha gets up. She's wearing a mink coat. And she slowly takes off the mink coat. Not in a striptease, believe me. But in this elegant way. Walks up to the center of the stage. And then she just starts to belt. Like only Aretha can. The audience rises. This gets out on YouTube, and I mean, it just goes viral. Because, well, this ain't rap, this ain't country, this ain't even rock. This is something different, folks. When Aretha's singing like this, this is God. This is unbelievable. More from the Kennedy Center right here. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, celebrating the life, the art, the work of the great Carole King in concert with the great Aretha Franklin, only in America.
Kitchen, clean my dear, and have a little song.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution,
great literature, philosophy, all the things that matter in life. In this feature, you're about to meet someone you've probably heard of, but probably don't know. A woman who traveled 21,740 miles, spending nearly 1,400 hours in transit through England, the Suez Canal, Sri Lanka, and Japan, in order to get back to New Jersey, my home state. All she got was a monkey and a new world record. Her name, Nellie Bly. And on this day in history, in the year 1890, she set the world record for fastest trip around the world. Nellie did it in just 72 days. She wrote a book about her experiences, but in the life story of Nellie Bly, this was just a chapter in the middle. Nellie was born as Elizabeth Jane Cochran in Cochran's Mill, Pennsylvania. Her Irish immigrant family had been successful enough to have the town named after her father. Michael Cochran had 10 children with his first wife, and after she died, he remarried and had 5 more, including Nellie. When Michael died, he left no will protecting his second wife, or the then 6-year-old Nellie. The next years were rough. Nellie's mother married and then divorced an abusive alcoholic. Nellie went to school to become a teacher but couldn't afford tuition past the first semester. She spent the next few years working odd jobs around a boarding house, but her real break came when she read an exchange in the Pittsburgh Dispatch. An anxious father wrote in to ask Pittsburgh's most popular columnist what he should do about his 5 unmarried daughters. The columnist Erasmus Wilson wrote a reply titled, "What Girls Are Good For." According to Wilson, women belonged in the home as a working woman was surely a monstrosity. And he went further to suggest, possibly in jest, that Americans might just have to kill baby girls. Nellie was not amused. She wrote a fiery response under the pseudonym Lonely Orphan Girl. The paper's editor recognized a good thing when he saw it, so he took out an ad asking the mysterious writer to visit his office. When she did, George Madden offered her a job. And this was also when she took her pen name of Nellie Bly, after the Stephen Foster song. Nellie covered what the media ignored. She took a job in a factory and wrote a series of articles on the conditions facing poor working girls and women. In a twist straight out of Will Ferrell's Anchorman, the paper's editors saw this fearless investigator and decided she would be put to better use writing about fashion and flower shows for the women's pages. Nellie somehow talked her way out of this to become the paper's foreign correspondent in Mexico. There, she wrote about the everyday lives of Mexicans, but took a special interest in how the dictator Diaz had a habit of throwing journalists in prison. So naturally, the government threatened her with just that, unless she left. Back in Pittsburgh, the editors weren't going to let her wiggle out of the women's pages again. So Nellie did what you might expect. She left her boss a note, saying simply, "I'm off for New York. Look out for me. Bly." Nellie spent 6 months penniless, trying to break into the New York scene. She finally got a meeting at Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. In the late 1880s, New York, one developing issue was the treatment of patients in the city's mental institutions. In what might have been an attempt to brush off this persistent little girl from Pennsylvania, the New York World's managing editor, John Cockerell, asked Nellie to write a piece on one of New York's major asylums. Well, Nellie was game. Actually, that might be a bit of an understatement. She stopped bathing and brushing her teeth. She found the most tattered clothes she could. She stayed awake all night, making faces at herself in the mirror, taking notes like, "Faraway expressions look crazy." Posing as a Cuban immigrant, Nellie Moreno, she checked into a boarding house and let loose her best crazy act. The staff and other residents bought it. So did the police, a judge, and several doctors at Bellevue Hospital's psych ward. Her impression was so good, in fact, that other newspapers at the time wrote articles about this so-called mysterious waif with the wild, hunted look in her eyes. Declaring Nellie Bly to be positively demented, the doctors sent her off to a women's lunatic asylum on Blackwell's Island. This was America's first municipal mental health hospital, opened in 1839. Others had reported on conditions in the asylum, including Charles Dickens, who described it as a very painful experience. But no journalist was as courageous or creative as Nellie Bly. From the inside, Nellie witnessed the plight of patients surrounded by oblivious doctors and orderlies who choked, beat, and harassed patients. Some weren't insane at all, just recent immigrant women who didn't speak English. Regarding the daily conditions of the committed women, Nellie wrote this, quote, "What accepting torture would produce insanity quicker than this treatment? Take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up and make her sit from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on straight back benches. Do not allow her to talk or move during these hours. Give her no reading and let her know nothing of the world or its doings. Give her bad food and harsh treatment and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck." When the patients weren't kept in isolation, other so-called therapies weren't necessarily better. Quote, "My teeth chattered and my limbs were goose-fleshed with blue and cold. Suddenly I got, one after another, 3 buckets of water over my head, ice-cold water too, into my eyes, my ears, my nose, my mouth. I think I experienced the sensation of drowning as they dragged me, gasping, shivering, and quaking from the tub. For once I did look insane." The funny thing is that as soon as Nellie entered the asylum, she largely dropped her insane act. But the staff only took that as a further confirmation of her craziness. After 10 days locked up, Nellie's paper sent a lawyer to get her out, and she went to work. Her first article ran just 2 days later. The doctors and others responsible hemmed and hawed, trying every line in the book to excuse the inexcusable. A grand jury launched its own investigation and asked Nellie to assist because presumably few of them wanted to experience the rancid food force-feeding experience firsthand. The story made waves across America, driving broad reforms in how asylums were run and patients were screened. Nellie went on to write several investigative and editorial series on the conditions in New York jails and corruption among legislators. By 1889, she wanted a change of pace. Inspired by a Jules Verne novel, Around the World in 80 Days, Nellie told her editor she wanted to have a try at just such an adventure. Her boss was intrigued, but the people with the checkbooks, less so. No one had attempted to make such a trip in so little time. Besides, she's an unchaperoned woman. When some of the newspaper management seized on that point, Nellie said, "Well, very well. Start the man and I'll start the same day for some other newspaper and beat him." So Nellie got the green light. In addition to the dress she was wearing, Nellie packed a coat, several changes of underwear, a small bag of toiletries, and some banknotes and gold. As she later wrote, "It will be seen that if one is traveling simply for the sake of traveling and not for the purpose of impressing one's fellow passengers, the problem of baggage becomes a simple one." She departed Hoboken, New Jersey, and journeyed by ship, rail, horse, rickshaw, and burro. Along the way, she visited Jules Verne himself in France, stopped by a leper colony in China, and bought that monkey in Singapore. Thanks to telegraphs, submarine cables, she filed dispatches along the way in one of the great media publicity stunts of the era. She made it home in 72 days, 6 hours, 11 minutes, and 14 seconds, beating both the titular 80 days and her own target time of 75. Back in America, Nellie married and began working at her husband's business, the Ironclad Manufacturing Company, which made everything from milk cans to oil drums. She received patents for her new ideas of a milk container and stacking garbage cans. When the company went under because of her embezzling employees, Nellie went back to journalism. She died at age 57, as another fearless American innovator our words are inadequate to describe. Perhaps we should remember this remarkable woman not just by the fake insanity or her pet monkey, but by some words that launched her career. Here is some of her advice to that anxious father, wondering what to do about his poor, helpless daughters. Quote, "How many wealthy and great men could be pointed out who started in the depths But where are the many women? Let a youth start as errand boy, and he will work his way up until he is one of the firm. Girls are just as smart, a great deal quicker to learn. Why, then, can't they do the same? She continued, here would be a good field for believers in women's rights. Let them forgo their lecturing and writing and go to work. More work, less talk. Take some girls that have ability, procure for them situations, start them on their way, and by doing so, accomplish more than by years of talking. Nellie Bly. This day in history. What a story. Great job on that, Alex.